was Show Me the Meaning of Being Lonely. You're listening to DJ Mad Hatter on WMAT 92.1, playing all the hits of 1998, 99, and the year 2000. That throwback was by request, a dedication from Bri to Joe. Too much?
No, that was perfect.
All right. Welcome to wherever you are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to episode 81 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. Today's guest confounds me a little bit. Besides what? His own website, his own website and his own podcast, he somehow manages to find the time for write for what seems like 10 other sites and about 4 other podcasts on all manner of topics. This, of course, comes on top of having a steady 9-to-5 job and a life and everything else that a regular person would want. So it's kind of what prevents me from making fun of him for his Backstreet Boys fandom.
Yeah, well, you know me. I'm a Renaissance man.
Yeah, well, it's almost what prevents me from making fun of him for his Backstreet Boys fandom. We're back across a wire outside of Washington, D.C. for the owner and proprietor of DearFilm.net and Outside the Envelope podcast. It's Brian J. Rowan back on the show. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. I'm better now that I'm back on the show.
You're back actually pretty quickly. I'm known for going years without getting people back on.
That was my major concern, because I've been listening to you, and there was one girl who I think she got like the third round of Know Your Enemy.
Right.
And you were just like, this has rarely ever happened. And I was just like, damn, I have people back on my show all the time. How long do I have to wait?
Well, speaking of, when am I coming back on your show?
I don't know when you want to come back. Do you have a specific?
You're the host, man. I don't invite myself over.
I'm so lackadaisical about stuff like that. I mean, if you have a film that you'd like to come on to talk about, like, you know, that's going to come out, then just let me know.
Bring me in for the next Step Up movie. How about that?
Oh, God. I mean, you know how my show is running now. I mean, people vote on what to do.
That's right. It might be apropos. On episode 81, we will be discussing The Incredible Burt Wonderstone. It'll be fun, I promise. We'll be fielding listener feedback on films that don't hold up. We'll be turning the record over to play the other side. Of course, we need to learn more about Brian. First, though, we have another request here on WMET 92.1. It goes from Bri Guy to JoJo. Bri Guy did have a dedication he wanted me to accompany the song with, but all I could make out through the sobs and blubbering was Baby Please.
You are my fire, the one desire, believe when I say I want it that way.
I am baffled and amazed.
And I'm just getting started. Back on episode 63, the culmination of the podcast trilogy, we learned that the first film Brian had ever seen in a theater was Jurassic Park. The last film he'd seen at the time was Win-Win, which I still haven't seen. The worst film and the launch of DearFilm.net was Remember Me. The unseen classic or essential was Metropolis. How's that coming?
Still in progress.
Yeah, that's usually the answer. And the movie he wished he'd made was The Tree of Life. Round two. Brian, yep. Sir, what's a film you like that few other people do?
This was a tough one because I feel I work in two different groups. There's the normal people who just like to go to the Megaplex and watch like Transformers. And then there's the crazy cinephiles. So it was hard to figure out which group I should go with. But I'm going to say that I always perplex the cinephiles when I talk about my love of Battle Los Angeles.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Okay.
Have you seen Battle Los Angeles?
It was on TV the other day, and I was tuned in long enough to identify it. Now, which is dumb, because I could have just hit the info button on my remote and figured out what it was. But to me, that's cheating.
Okay.
I get
that.
And you genuinely like it. Like, it was fun for you.
Oh, yeah. I went to the movie theater because they put out a really great trailer for it. And I thought that it couldn't live up to it. And then I just heard all the vitriol that was like larded upon this movie just endlessly by all of the people that I respected. So I was like, you know, maybe I should go and check it out, because at first I was just going to leave it. But then I wanted to see how bad this movie was. And I actually dug it. Hmm. Like, I don't know why. It has many numerous flaws. I mean, all the characters are two-dimensional. I mean, the funny thing is, I think in my review, I compared it to Avatar. And it was kind of like Avatar suffers all the same problems that this movie does, like the stupid two-dimensional characters. But everyone was so in love with Avatar. And I couldn't figure out why Battle Los Angeles got such a bad rap.
See, part of me thinks, and we're going to talk about this later, part of me thinks that the bar just got lowered just enough for you that when you went and saw it and you thought, hey, that's not that bad, it actually, it helped the whole case.
Well, no, because I was thinking about that, but when you were a kid, did you ever see like an action movie and then you just left the theater and you were like really amped and you wish that you like could get your friends together to like pantomime that movie?
I didn't have friends.
Okay, well, if you had had friends.
Thank you for that.
Let's move on. If you had friends, you would know that, like, you want to, when you see a movie like that, it kind of energizes you. And I was just like, how freaking awesome and cool would it have been to have been part of that group and just run around shooting aliens? Okay. It was
I haven't seen it, so I can't say you're wrong, even though I do enjoy doing that. Listen, the next time I'm flipping channels and it's on, or who knows, I'll check the PVR. Maybe I can find it. You know, they tend to replay that stuff often. I'll give it a watch, and you know, just because I know you dig it. I can actually think of a few answers for this, but I'm curious which one you're going to go with. What's the film that everybody else likes that you don't?
I think I kind of decided to go along with the most recent and most baffling, which was Cloud Atlas.
No, that's too divisive. I'm calling an audible on that one. You've got more arrows in your quiver. That one was a 50-50 split at best.
Oh, come on. I mean, but like most people, I think it was probably just the people I follow on Twitter. They were so into that movie and became like a thing where I was terrified to speak out against it. It was pretty bad.
Okay. all right, no, screw it. I'll let you have that one.
Okay. I mean, I could think of another one off the top,
could think of like six. I can name two off the top of my head.
Okay, wait. So what did you think?
The two that came to my brain for you were either The Avengers or Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah, no, Scott. Yeah, both of those are actually really good.
It's not just... Know Your Host. That's not the name of the segment. Screw it. We're moving on. What was the last film to make you cry?
This actually is going to be another one that I like that a lot of people gave a lot of crap to. This is Les Miserables.
Like the recent one?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Really? I'm a fan of the musical. And like, honestly, the way that they shot that with the live singing and like the intense close ups, it was affecting. And one or two scenes, I think they were all actually with Hugh Jackman. Mm hmm. There's the scene where the bishop gives him the silver and, you know, gives him a reprieve and says he has to go on the righteous path. And for some reason, that's always been a very deeply affecting scene for me.
Okay.
Even in the musical. So to see it more up close and more intimate was pretty intense. And then, like, of course,
that's like 15 minutes in. You were in a rough night.
I was in. It was. Oh, no. The second that happened and I could feel. And this is like, I don't cry during movies, but I get choked up to the point where if someone just gave me a little nudge, I would go over. So I think like the literal last film I ever cried at was The Thin Red Line, but I was probably about 12 when I saw that. So
okay. So you're saying it was the emotional moment.
It's the choke up. It's the I can't speak right now because I'm Irish and I'm holding it back.
Gotcha. Okay. I wasn't a fan. I can certainly see how that would be affecting. Jackman is one of the best parts of that movie, and certainly so is Anne Hathaway, and her scene I imagine would be kind of affecting as well.
It was affecting.
Not to say the least, because she's basically like singing through sobs herself, and it's that kind of thing where when you see somebody else go, you're gone too.
Yeah, no, I'm terrible with crying people around me, and that was such a raw scene. I was also in the third row because the theater was packed.
Oh wow.
So I was like right there. I was escape it. Okay. Terrible.
In the movie of your life, who plays you?
Michael Fassbender. And this has nothing to do with like wish fulfillment regarding physique.
Lies.
This is lies? No. It's legitimately, and I probably have said this on two or three other podcasts. There is a scene in that movie that so perfectly encapsulates the way I feel about so many people. Shame.
Right?
I'm just digging. I'm digging my grave deeper.
Clearly.
It's when he's talking to his sister, Sissy, mm-hmm. and she's saying that she's trying to help him. And he's like really almost violently angry. And he's like, you know, how are you helping me? You're a weight on me. You like drag me down.
Right.
Yeah. And I feel that way about a lot of people in my life. And I feel like he really captures the intensity of the way that I wish I could yell at certain people.
I kind of feel like we have to have a whole other show for that. You know what's funny about Fassbender? This is going to sound terrible, but it's my moment of pettiness. I don't care.
Okay.
So you know, he's one of those guys in the movies. Like he's like a guy's guy. Like, there's a couple actors kind of like him that when they're on screen, he's the kind of actor or the kind of guy I'd like in my ideal self I would be like, right?
Exactly.
But here's the funny thing: I don't think I've actually seen him in a film where he uses his own accent. He might use it in Hunger, which I haven't seen.
Hunger is fantastic.
Yeah, I've been trying to track it down for ages, and it's nuts that I can't see it. But
it's on. Oh wait, you're in Canada,
right? Never. There it is. The first time I actually heard him speak with his own accent, he was on The Daily Show and he was doing an interview, and his accent, it's kind of a, how do I put this? It's a very kind of bumpkin-y dialect. So it's kind of the least charming I've ever heard him. And that's the way he actually speaks. So I was like, oh no, it kind of brought him down a few pegs for me.
That's unfortunate.
I know. And I feel like that is the pettiest thing I've ever said. Like, here's a great dude. And then he opened his mouth.
I was about to say, holy yeah. God.
So I had to get it out there. Cause you know, what the hell, we're all friends here. Next, last but not least, what's the film you're watching next?
It's probably going to be Rust and Bone.
I'll be curious to know what you think of that.
I've already seen it, man. There's a review on my site.
Oh, I do read it.
It's okay.
We're all busy. In that case, then remind me, what did you think?
It's just so powerful, and it's like a terrifying and awe-inspiring film, and you get wrapped up in it so much. And there, I mean, towards the end, it just becomes almost unbearable, the amount of like effort and care that you've put into these characters,
yeah.
And to see them continue to struggle the way that they are, it's like you've become their closest friend and you just want things to be okay. And it's just them fighting against their own selves, and there's nothing you can do to help them.
Yeah, no arguments here. I liked the movie. I saw that one at TIFF last year, which, by the way, we're starting a whisper campaign to get Brian J. Rowan to come up to TIFF 2013, so tell your friends. But I saw that one at TIFF last year, and I found that I liked the movie, but I loved Cotillard's performance.
Yeah, she is. It.
Like, she was by far the strongest thing. I am curious. Did you ever read the book? I'm kind of curious to read the book.
I didn't read the book, and when I bought the movie on Amazon, I saw that the book was there, and I was this close. You can't see it, but my fingers are pretty close together.
Right.
That close to purchasing the book as well.
Cool. Well, I definitely need to give it another watch. So, that's Brian J. Rowan. We'll learn more about him when he inevitably turns back up in another 9 months. We'll come right back after this with your chance to come talk to me. Before that, though, we're going back to the request line here at WMAT 92.1. This one goes out to Magnetic in Manhattan from Miserable in Maryland. He says that he has everything as long as you love him. I don't care who. Well, my last episode, you okay?
No, you need to give me a little more time to stop laughing at you. Oh, my God.
In episode...
This is going to start rumors.
Yeah.
Rumors will fly.
Oh, wow. You're Jesus. Single now. Joanna will probably kill me, but you know, I don't have to worry about you.
That's true.
After episode 81, I asked what was a film that had people watched and it hadn't held up. Now, I do apologize because I was kind of vague about that question. I was wondering... kind of some of the ones that hadn't stood up to time, or some people took it as films that maybe they were just too jacked about the first time they watched it. So I've got a litany of answers here. The longest one came from Will Malone, who sent me a whole email, said, just a quick thought on your recent question of which films have not aged well. Personally, I find most films I enjoy the first time around tend to stand up pretty well on a rewatch. For me, films, much like music, are often linked in my own mind to personal experiences. Therefore, if I revisit a film which I enjoyed from, say, the 80s or 90s, even if it was very age-specific plotline or indeed low-tech special effects, the nostalgia for the era or the fun I had the first time normally comes flooding back, so giving me a similar level of enjoyment. I genuinely cannot think of a film which I enjoyed the first time around which I disliked on a rewatch, but hey, I'm pretty easy to please, maybe too easy. Perhaps I should be more critical in my watching. Keep up the good stuff, Will. Well, that is a good answer. I hadn't really thought of it that way, that, you know, along with what's happening on the screen that we can associate it with you know, things that were going on around us.
Yeah.
So there's that.
It's a good point.
Yeah. On Facebook, Satu Aholin is a subscriber to the Matinee Facebook page out of Finland. She said, Poltergeist. I was so scared by it the first time when I was little. I didn't watch it for years, and I saw it again only a couple of years ago. Well, if you've seen it, it looks a lot. It looks very 80s, and it does look very. You've seen Poltergeist, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
How did it hold up for you?
Actually, you know, it's funny because I know I saw it when I was a little kid, and I don't think I've gone back to it since. So in my head, it's still just as terrifying. So
you see static on a TV and you're freaked.
Yeah, I'm so happy that TVs don't really do that anymore.
Oh, that's true, too. Yeah. Steve Honeywell down in Chicago, he said Stripes. I say blasphemy to that. Funny as hell when I was in high school. Now, not nearly as much. I still like Stripes.
I feel like comedies, though, are harder to judge by that because a lot of what makes them hilarious is just the unexpected nature of it.
That's true. I got a bunch of the locals responded. My friend Kurt Halfyard said, Evil Dead. Oh, wait, just the remake. Carry on. I guess he's not a fan. He's seen it already and he's not a fan. Courtney Small, big thoughts from a small mind, said Caddyshack. It's painful to watch now. Well, see, there's the comedy again. And the Bill Murray comedies at that.
Why people got to be like that?
I don't know. Justin Mohareb said something called the Canadian Conspiracy. It's so inside baseball and not actually funny. I have not even heard of this. I'm imagining it might be before my time.
I've never heard of it.
Well, of course not. You're not Canadian.
It's true.
Sean Patrick Kelly said he just watched The Mask for the first time on a big screen. The film is nearly 20 years old now, and the CGI effects are getting dated. However, it still fit within the cartoony feel of the film. I haven't watched The Mask in forever.
You're going to have to give me a second to wrestle with my own mortality, because I can't believe that movie's almost 20 years old.
It's nuts, isn't it?
I thought the same thing when I was like, oh yeah, Jurassic Park's getting released because of its 20-year anniversary.
And then you're like,
and then I just started hyperventilating.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, oh God.
Yeah, there it is. Robert Harding said Police Academy. There's another 80s comedy. Man, that series didn't age well. I'm not sure what we all saw in those films that managed to garner so many sequels. It's one film I'd actually like to see remade or rebooted. Do you know how often as a kid I watched Police Academy?
Probably as often as I did.
And only later on did I realize how horribly inappropriate that was.
I feel like a lot of movies were like that. Like, I watched Ace Ventura, going back to the Jim Carrey films. I can't believe that my parents let me watch that when it first came out.
My thinking is just that, like, a lot of the sex humor just sailed right over my head.
I didn't even realize that. I mean, never mind.
I'm pretty sure I know where you're going, and neither did I. Hey, if you're a listener, just fill in the blanks. On Twitter, Sam Akash in Australia said The Last of the Mohicans felt like an aged 90s telly movie.
Oh, that's nonsense.
The score and the soft lighting really aged it for her.
I can understand getting tired of the score because you kind of hear it everywhere. But, I mean, that's such a good movie.
Yeah. Anna, the MovieNet 1416 in upstate New York, said Seven. I wasn't as scared by it the second time around.
But again, horror is the same as comedy when you know what's coming.
Yeah, I think that's the mark of really good horror is when when somebody watches it in the broad light of day, no pun intended, how well does it work? My guest from the last episode, Nikharath Zara, said loads of Bollywood films. I don't have the vocabulary for that yet, Nick, but I'm trying. Also, Bring It On, painful as hell now. What's with the screechy voices of the cheerleaders? Hear, hear. Andrew Robinson, who's G-Man Reviews, he says Gangs in New York. Besides Daniel Day-Lewis, the movie does not have much to offer.
That's madness.
I'm an apologist for that movie.
I love that movie.
I know. I can see the great movie in there. It's not that good, but I can see the great movie in there.
It's unfortunate that I think that, you know, they made him cut around and, you know, butcher it to get it theatrical. And he's a purist, you know, he won't put out a director's cut. So.
You got it. That's right.
It's a shame.
Jess from Real Insight, most of the John Grisham films of the 90s, so The Pelican Brief, The Firm, The Client.
Those feel like television movies.
Yeah, that's true.
Because they're based on a John Grisham novel.
Well, I know. I read way too many of those when I was younger. too over the top and relied on issues that don't exist anymore. I guess certainly with something like The Pelican Brief, probably.
Yeah.
And you know, slightly like A Time to Kill. I don't know about The Firm. Simon over at Screen Insight said Cruel Intentions. For some reason I thought it was a sexy film to watch with girls. Now I realize it insulted and degraded them.
Yeah, wait, what? I just
you know, I wrote that into my own show notes and I didn't read it until just now.
I just can't, like, who, that's such an interesting way to, like, catalog movies. Like, this is a sexy film, but this is a sexy film to watch with girls.
You know, I don't, I try not to, to criticize other people's moves, you know, so for all I know, that was called the Simon in London. We don't know. Finally,
get a girl over to my house, yeah, bust out the cruel intentions.
Yeah.
You know where,
yeah,
it goes from, yeah, there.
You know, after that, we'll put on Bring It On. Rachel over at Real Insight finally said, since everyone's going gaga over the Kick-Ass 2 trailer, I'd have to say Kick-Ass. And then actually, yep, after that on Twitter, Simon came in and agreed with her. To this, I call foul.
That is, no, that's wrong. I saw that movie like 2 weeks ago.
Exactly. And I, well, not only that, like, I like the film, but that's a different argument. What I'm saying is, if you're saying that a film you watched 3 years ago doesn't hold up, something went wrong somewhere.
Yeah, I feel like you just didn't like the film.
Maybe. Like, no offense to Rachel or Simon, but I think that maybe, like, you got caught up in hype or whatnot. I don't know. Or maybe that you're just going along with it in the first place. I don't know. But that's my thing, is if something that recent, it'd be like, if it turns on you that much, something went wrong. What about you? Could you think of a film that hasn't held up for you?
No, I had a lot of trouble with this one, and I think it was for the same reason that the gentleman who went first pointed out. Just because when I watch the movie, I'm not just experiencing the movie again. I'm kind of being brought back to when I first saw it. So there was nothing that really really stood out in my head.
See, it's hard because, like, this is kind of why, this is actually what sparked my Falling for the First Time series, because I was getting into arguments with people who had a nostalgic attachment to films. If you watch some of these movies without your baggage, you kind of start to notice the cracks, and I got people who hadn't seen them at all to start watching them. And this was even after I discounted ones that I was pretty sure weren't going to hold up. Like, I started offering up stuff like Ghostbusters and Back to the Future and Ferris Bueller. I'm like, there's no way somebody's going to like this. And people were coming back with flaws. Speaking of mine, actually, I did come up with a few, and at the risk of heresy, some of those John Hughes movies do not hold up that well. And I'm thinking specifically of 16 Candles.
Yeah.
To a lesser extent, Some Kind of Wonderful, but definitely Weird Science.
See, those I feel like have morphed into kitsch,
right?
So I don't know that
talking about them as like modern classics. And
no, oh yeah, I never understood that. No,
Weird Science, I couldn't even get through.
No, I can't. No, that's those are ones that are so far removed that if you don't look at them as an artifact from somewhere else.
Well, for episode 82, we're going to be talking about trance, and that involves a crime of some sort, but kind of on the whole crime angle, and we're going to be talking about a Vegas movie coming up. I want you to cast the perfect heist team. So give me, I don't care if you want to go with like three actors or you want to Ocean's 11 this shit. I want your dream cast for a heist film. So let me know. Ryan at thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I'm matinee_CA, Facebook, yeah, leave me a comment. You know where to find me. We're going to go on to the new slang. The new slang is the incredible Burt Wonderstone. First, though, we're going back to the request line. Hi, what's your name?
Brian Rowan.
And what do you want to hear tonight?
BSB.
The BSB. Well, I can play that for you. Is there anyone special you want to send that out to?
Yeah, my special lady up north. It's a secret. She knows who she is.
Oh, she knows. Okay. Well, we'll do that then. Here it comes, Backstreet Boys on WMAT 92.1.
You're the one for me. You're my ecstasy. You're the one I need.
New slang is the incredible Burt Wonderstone. It is directed by Don Scardino. It's written by John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein. It stars Steve Carell, Steve Buscemi, Olivia Wilde, Jim Carrey, Alan Arkin, and James Gandolfini. It is about a pair of friends named Burt Wonderstone and Anton Marvelton, who are Vegas magicians. One day, though, they lose their mojo and are usurped by a new magician whose name is Steve Gray, the brain rapist. That's wonderful. And hilarity ensues. Mr. Rowan, what did you think of The Incredible Burt Wonderstone?
This is a movie that suffers from excessive mediocrity.
That should go on the poster.
Hey, thank you. I don't know, because I started off watching it, obviously, sitting in the theater. And each trailer that came up, I kind of was like invested in more than I ended up being invested in the actual movie. And considering that one of the trailers was The Host, I feel like that's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, like, it starts off okay. It's got these two little kids who are both kind of picked on, and they retreat into this world of creating illusions and magic. And the kids were actually weirdly affecting, and I liked their relationship. But then it jumps forward in time, and yeah, from that point on, it's just kind of awful. Like, and it's not awful in like the way where you're sitting there thinking about how bad it is and how bad, like, poorly everything went. It's not like suffering from ambition, you know, that's too big for its foundations. It just never really attempts anything that's going to be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's strange because I don't want to say I did not enjoy myself, because that's a lie. It's a comedy. There are certain moments that made me laugh. To that end, to me, it did the trick. It's like deeply, deeply flawed. But every once in a while, something would come up and I'd get to thinking about it, or I just kind of watch something play out and I'd be amused. Now, I think if the film had a problem for me, it's that it could never build any kind of momentum.
No,
you know, like, I'd see a neat scene or a neat joke or a great little moment between two characters, and then we'd wade through the muck for another 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Which is kind of strange. For me, one of the problems is, so Steve Carell, as Burt Wonderstone, he starts out the movie and he's just super, super hammy. He's way over the top. He's like Michael Scott on steroids in an Andre Agassi wig.
Yeah.
But when he finally does dial it back around the film's second half, all of a sudden I started liking him.
First of all, to address what you said, I think that the perfect way to say what Steve Carell is like the frat guy who's a little too drunk doing his impression of Will Ferrell in Anchorman.
That'll do. Okay.
Yeah,
well done. In an Andre Agassi wig.
In an Andre Agassi wig. You cannot deny the wig, because the wig comes and goes without mention.
Yes.
And not only that, but his unnatural tan. I wasn't sure what parts of his character was supposed to be hilariously overwrought and what parts were just bad production design.
Yeah. I see, that's the thing. Like, the tan made me laugh.
The tan made me laugh, but I wasn't sure if I was, because no one else addresses it. There's not a point where someone says, you know, your tan is excessive.
No, somebody says your skin makes me sad. I can't remember who. It might be Jim Carrey.
I thought that he was just quoting Radiohead because he was supposed to be like a punk guy.
I don't think so. I think that was where I took it, was that self-tan is the sadness.
That's possible. But see, here's my thing. This movie feels like it was written 14 years ago. And like, that quoting that Radiohead song at the time would have been a vaguely timely reference.
Okay.
And so I was like, well, maybe they just didn't upgrade the reference. Like, I don't know. I don't know why he's quoting Radiohead.
Maybe.
But yeah, I know what you mean, because somewhere towards the last part of the movie, I finally started to like the protagonist.
Yeah.
But at that point, it's just a little bit too late.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, it's everything kind of comes together around the time that Alan Arkin shows up.
Yeah. Oh, man. No, exactly. I mean, I wasn't sure what constitutes a spoiler in this. I don't know.
You know what? I don't really think there's much to be spoiled.
No, there's really not.
It's drummed up as a smackdown between these two magicians, and that doesn't really happen
until
very late in the game. So I'm just going to say screw it. That's the way they marketed it. That's the way we're going to talk about it.
And it's so easy to pick out where it's going to.
Yeah, yeah. That's
it really does. And I think that's where a lot of the plotting you were talking about comes from, like the slug. It's just like, I know where this is going.
Yep.
Just get me there and start making some damn jokes.
Yes, please. But that's the thing. Arkin shows up. And, like, I almost want Alan Arkin to be in every movie, because it feels like every time he shows up just for a few minutes, he elevates everything around him.
Absolutely.
And that was the thing. That was exactly what he did here. And he really, he put a point on it. He said to Wonderstone, that feeling that you're feeling, that wonderness of a kid, that's what you want your audience to feel. This isn't genuine for you anymore. You're phoning it in.
And that's incredible because I wrote down in my notes at that line, I was like, I had previously written down in my notes, like, one of the things that attracts us to movies about magic is that we want to believe that there is some kind of magic out there, even if we're being shown how it's done.
Yeah.
You know, the mere act that it is being forced upon us is interesting and new. And I mean, I can't do sleight of hand. Like, I can't make the card appear. I can't turn a red dice black. So things like that still interest me. And so when he says that, it seems like it shouldn't be a big revelation.
But
and
it
Yeah. And I wrote down, so the last joyless 1.75 hours were on purpose.
And that's the thing. Like, he's supposed to be... You're not like somebody commented on my review, said he's not supposed to be likable in the beginning. Well, yeah, agreed. But I don't think he should be that detestable either.
There's a difference between someone not being likable and someone being someone that you hope to fail.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, that's yeah.
Will Ferrell's character, again, going because this movie seems very clearly based off of the idea of something like Anchorman.
Yep.
And I mean, Will Ferrell's character is a like. Ignorant misogynist
ass.
Yeah, ass. He's a jackass. He's a terrible person. But for some reason, there's a goofiness and a sweetness and a lack of malice to him.
Yep.
He's just misguided. He just doesn't know better. Steve Carell in this movie is a son of a bitch.
Yeah, it's like you kind of put a pin on it. Like when he brings Jillian Jacobs up to his bedroom and he's just got the whole routine all laid out. Oh, pose like this. And, you know, like that. It's like you have been through this routine so many times that it's like you're out there dancing to Abracadabra. You know exactly how this night's going to go. It's just the young girl that's changing every time.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's no joy in it. So like when he loses all of it, aside from his ineptitude at dealing with the real world, there's not a lot of interest in it.
Nope. But
and you don't get to see him really enjoying it either. Like they jump forward in time so much that you miss the point where you get to see when he used to be a vivacious, interesting stage presence.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to hang out with him in that retirement home for a while.
Yeah.
Or you know, when he was getting back. Now, the kind of flip side to this, the one thing that did interest me, not so much for what was happening on screen, but kind of for what it represented, was Jim Carrey in this movie. As Steve Gray, because another thing that I wrote is when I was a kid, magicians were Siegfried and Roy and David Copperfield and that kind of thing. And now a magician is Chris Angel or a magician is David Blaine. And a trick is I can stand on top of a post for a week.
Yeah.
That's not a trick.
No, it's ridiculous. I don't know when that became magic.
Me neither. And that's like, I do love that they spoof it to the ultimate degree with, you know, Steve Gray is going to see how long he can hold his pee.
Yeah, that was funny. I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Like, I got a laugh out of the line when the doctor says he's got more urine than blood right now.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I'm laughing at that now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's that for me was one of those things that kind of carried me through when the film was really, really dragging. It was just that whole absurdity to it and the way that Jim Carrey just commits to it as Jim Carrey commits to like damn near everything.
And he's fantastic in this. And like there was a point when I wrote in my notes, just like, when is Jim Carrey coming back? Because even though he's the antagonist,
yeah,
he's still got more joy and wonder to him than Burt Wonderstone.
And absurdity, really.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what would have been a great film, I think, would be for a magician like Jim Carrey playing Steve Gray to have to become someone like Burt Wonderstone like normal magic, because I don't understand why the Chris Angel style of magic became popular for like the 5 years it was popular.
It still is, man. He still packs him in Vegas.
I don't know why. And see, here's the thing, I guess I'm a little removed from the Vegas magic scene, because all I kept thinking was like, this was timely a long time ago, like pre-college is when this stuff started really kicking into gear.
Has Blaine done a stunt in a while?
I don't think so. That's why I felt like so removed from this. And I thought he gave up after the box in London. I think so.
Which, you know, they do that. The Marvelton and Wonderstone go into the box for a minute. You're right. Like, this movie is a mess. But just the kind of things that it took me away from and made me think about just barely carried me through. The other little absurd thing that I loved was when Marvelton goes off into he goes off on his own and he goes into the jungle and he's like, oh yeah, we're finding villages where they don't have food or clean water and we're bringing them magic.
Magic.
He's like, how are they taking to it? No, not really well. They more want food and clean water.
And the kid takes the rabbit, pulls out a knife.
Because I swear to God, that kind of stupid outreach kind of thing does happen.
Yeah.
You know, you'll
all
see
the time.
Yeah, you'll see it on like the Golden Globes. It's like, oh, we went to this village in, you know, dark Uganda and we showed them a movie. I was like, why would you do that? Why would you just take the money you spent on showing them the movie and buy them some food?
Yeah, if you want to do both at the same time, that's awesome. Like,
swell.
You know,
yeah,
help them get out of their shitty existence for 2 hours, but you know, also maybe give them a sack of rice.
Yeah. Yes. So I think we, like, you know, we're kind of dancing around the obvious, but neither one of us really liked this movie, although I think I liked it a little more than you did.
Yeah.
But
well, I think one of my other major problems with it is, like, again, going with the Anchorman template, I mean, they even had their female upstart magician,
yeah,
in Olivia Wilde, and she's like wasted.
Yeah, they keep
she's
her in,
so
they
wasted.
Keep her in dry dock the whole damn time. I really thought that she was gonna get into the fracas more than she was. That's probably actually the biggest drawback of the whole damn thing, is they just keep her on the sidelines.
Yeah, she starts off literally on the sidelines.
Yep.
And then she kind of moves into the center a little bit, but then she's back on the side, and it turns out that she's actually a really good, clever magician. But then when the time comes for them to, like, bust out and save their career, like, I thought she was going to come up with something.
That's what I thought, or that they were going to incorporate her into the act, because by the end, it seems like, you know, like, she's the opener, and she's part of the headline. It's
right.
Marvelton and Wonderstone and the Incredible, and Jane the Amazing, or whatever her name is.
You never see her perform.
Yeah, well, we saw her do, like, two little tricks in her hotel room. Yeah,
she turned a $5 bill into a butterfly, and only in front of Bert. Her entire arc is just to get Bert to like her.
Right, because that would be difficult.
Oh yeah, no, it's impossible.
Well, did you have a souvenir for this movie? Like, what was the one takeaway that you would keep from this whole thing?
If I could learn to do magic, like sleight of hand magic, okay. I've always wanted to be able to do that.
Okay.
Have you ever seen the movie Red Belt?
No.
Okay.
Is there magic in that?
Yeah, there is.
Wow.
There's a oddly enough, there's a guy in it. I don't remember his name. He is an Asian magician. And he does all the sleight of hand stuff. So, you know, he'll pass his hand over his other hand that has like a quarter in it, and suddenly the quarter will be a penny. Or he'll like push a cigarette into his hand, it'll disappear, and then it'll like fall out of the sky. And he'll do that kind of what they did in this movie with the coins, flipping them over their knuckles. Like, he can do that with a cigarette.
Huh.
So just being able to do that would be kind of awesome, just on a fulfilling level for me.
Not bad.
For some reason.
Not bad. For me, the one takeaway, one of those things that I did laugh at, and we didn't really talk about him, but in the background of this whole fracas is James Gandolfini as Doug Money, and he's one of these Vegas tycoons who owns a few different hotels. What's on the line for these two magical acts is a headlining gig at his new hotel, and he calls his new hotel the Doug. Which to me, that's just like absurdly awesome.
Yeah.
For no other reason than the fact that his last name is Money. You know, you could have called it the Money or just Money, but no, we call it the Doug, it's got to be the dumbest name for a hotel ever.
Yeah.
That's great. That's the thing. And that's kind of frustrating, because that's good writing, and I wish there was more of that.
Yeah. And it's the slight thing, the thing that you notice and think about and laugh, and that doesn't get shoved in your damn face.
Well, gird your loins, Mr. Rowan. I'm going to make you actually give a rating. So on a scale of 1 to 4 stars, what do you give The Incredible Burt Wonderstone?
I guess like a 2.
Okay. I'm giving it 2.5 just because, as I said, by the time I was done, it was just a welcome distraction. It's something, you know, if I saw it again, I might watch it for a little while. I did leave the theater with a smile. I'm certainly not saying to people, you should see this, but because of these other little things that it made me think about, I say 2.5.
I guess if you see it on TV and it's close to the end, watch through the end credits.
Was there a stinger? Did I miss it?
There wasn't a stinger, but you know, when the movie ends, it starts again, and it shows something that was elided over in the actual narrative.
Oh, okay. Okay. No, I did stay for that. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was pretty good, actually. So there we go. Yeah, stay for the credits. Let us know what you think. I imagine a lot of people are going to say that I'm nuts for kind of liking it, but what the hell. Ryan, that's thematinee.ca. Twitter, Facebook, leave me a comment about The Incredible Burt Wonderstone, if you saw it. Going back to the request line, this is for Jay from B. He says he's sorry he didn't pick up his cell phone when you were in the hospital, but his cell phone battery had died. Here's the Backstreet Boys on WMAT 92.1. I'm driving it into the ground, dude.
Yeah. Oh my god, I can't wait to hear this.
You have no idea how dirty I'm gonna feel downloading all this Backstreet Boys. I'm gonna feel so damn filthy. I might have to like download some porn to clean out my mouth.
Jesus.
So, for my selection on the other side, I went with the Vegas angle. Of course, the whole of Burt Wonderstone is set in Las Vegas. And I went back to 1995 for a kind of dark movie. Just a bit. Leaving Las Vegas, directed by Mike Figgis. It won Nicolas Cage an Oscar. Elizabeth Shue is also a star in this movie, and she was nominated for an Oscar. If you haven't seen it, Nicolas Cage plays Ben Sanderson, who has basically gone to Vegas to drink himself to death. When was the last? Did you rewatch the movie for this show? Or
I did not rewatch the movie for the show, but I saw it like a year ago.
Okay, that's close enough.
Yeah, you know, I just couldn't find it. I don't know where it is.
See, that's funny. I own a copy now. Like, let's I was gonna say start with that, but I actually watched this movie and I found myself thinking more than once, why do I own this?
Right, like what you were at some point probably standing in a store. And you saw it, and you were like, yeah.
No. I actually specifically bought it. Like, it was one of these things where I picked it up. I was like, I like this movie. I used to own a copy. And it's don't get me wrong. It's not because it's dark, because Lord knows I love the dark films. I call them sick day movies, really. okay. And this will make me feel great on a sick day. It's just that I look at it now, and it is so 90s. It is so amazingly 90s, it's not funny. If somebody asked me what was life like in the 90s or what were film like in the 90s, I would have to point them towards this movie, because everything about it, like the direction, the editing, the music, the cutting of it is just I'm like, what am I watching? This does not feel right anymore.
So how come this didn't come up in your movie that's don't hold up?
That or was what you, made me think you... of it. And that's actually part of the reason that was the question was late. And it came to me after watching Leaving Las Vegas.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was another one of my answers. I just didn't want to tip my hand.
But, I got you.
Like, did you notice that? Is it, am I just totally nuts?
No, I think you have a fair point about that. Yeah. Especially in terms of directing and editing.
Yeah. Like part of it feels like it's a hair's breadth away from being shown on Cinemax after 11.
Yes, it does.
And I don't say that because the score is like abundantly saxophone.
Even though it is.
It is. Yeah. Like that's probably what made me think of it. I do still like the story, even as somewhat absurd as it is. Can one drink oneself to death?
I mean, I would assume so, right? I mean, alcohol is not great for you. Yeah. I think you could. Yeah, you can get alcohol poisoning. I've had friends get alcohol poisoning. They've had to go to the ER, get their stomach pumped, and get a saline drip. So
he just skipped that part and went straight to it.
Yeah, he's just like, you know, I'm going to power through the alcohol poisoning and keep it going.
What did you think about, like, on rewatching it? Did you still dig it? Did you notice anything you didn't notice the first time?
I still dug it. Yeah, I still enjoyed it a lot. And I still love Nicolas Cage. In this, I think it kind of makes up for some of his other movie sins. the scene where he's in the bank.
Yeah.
Speaking into his tape recorder.
Right, right. Yeah, that is a pretty damn cool scene. Now, I can't remember. That's after he's got the shakes, right?
Yes.
Like, he's gone and he's put a few in himself and that steadies him.
Yeah.
Which seems completely ass backwards to me.
In a frightening
way. Yeah.
The thing is, the movie, like this movie and a movie with Nell and I.
Okay.
Both, every time I watch them, make me feel like I have a hangover.
Yeah.
Because they put me so firmly in the feeling of I just drank way too much, and the only way I'm going to get out of this hole is to drink again.
Yeah. There was one year I watched this the night before St. Patrick's Day, and I really didn't want to go out the next night.
I was about to say, was that you trying to like... level yourself out?
No, like, I mean before, not after. I was
no,
like,
I know, but you're like, okay, I'm gonna go crazy, so I should watch this to remind myself why I should not.
No, I happened to grab it. Remember, I had a copy.
Right, you own it. Never once in a while, you just gotta put it on.
It was just a bad idea.
See, that's funny, because every St. Patrick's Day I watch The Wind That Shakes the Barley, and I'm just like, yeah, I'm gonna go kill an Englishman.
whatever works for you, man. Right. Now, of course, I mentioned earlier on, I was on your show last spring when we talked about Shame.
Yes.
And it's one of these things where I couldn't help but think that, no, don't get me wrong, the two addictions cannot possibly be more different, because I think the one thing that sort of underlines sexual addiction and kind of makes it people think that it might not actually be an addiction is one can still stay relatively high functioning.
Oh yeah.
As opposed to alcohol addiction, where you just look like a sloven mess. But
absolutely.
His addiction didn't seem as bombastic in Shame as Nicolas Cage's alcoholism does in this movie.
Well, a function of that might be the direction.
Well, yeah.
You know, I mean, Steve McQueen gets called out for being kind of cold. So, you know, just the lack of underlining of all of his problems. But also, you know, having an orgasm is a lot different from having 17 shots of whiskey in a minute.
I don't know. I think you're doing it wrong. But then again, like, I mean, how bad can it be? He's got a hooker around to steady him out.
What?
in Leaving Las Vegas.
All right, I was about to say, like, wait, which one are we back on? Yeah.
No,
you got a sex addiction, but you've got a hooker to steady you out. You know, you got a constant hit.
Who Jesus. Needs a dealer?
Right.
No, I mean, Elizabeth Shue in this movie, and like, I think that might be the other thing that I think is so 90s, is it felt like for a while there in the 90s, we were going through this hooker with a heart of gold fetish, for lack of a better word. And she's one of the ones for sure. Like, yes. I can't imagine somebody who goes through what she goes through in this movie to just come up smiling every day.
Yeah. And it's I don't know what that was, like, what was going on in our culture
that
became a thing.
Yeah. I blame Pretty Woman myself.
I mean, well, yeah, but was that the one that started it?
I don't know.
I guess it must have been, right?
I should do a whole podcast dedicated to prostitute movies.
Oh my God, that would be incredible.
Make it happen.
I do love Julian Sands.
Which one is he in this?
He's Yuri. He's the...
Yuri.
Julian.
Yes, I'd forgotten Yuri.
Julian Sands is incredible. In fact, for maybe like a good month back a long time ago, I actually had a Tumblr, because everyone was doing Tumblrs, and I was like, well, what am I supposed to tumble about? Because every time a new social media thing pops up, I'm like, I gotta be in that. And my Tumblr was, oh shit, it's Julian Sands. And it was...
That's awesome.
It was based off the fact that every time Julian Sands would appear in a movie, me and my friends would get so unreasonably excited. And one of us would just scream, oh shit, it's Julian Sands. So, I mean, I just love him. He's awesome.
Oh my God. Yeah. But that's, again, that's part of the absurdity. Like, I can't believe I ever took this damn movie seriously. Of course she's got a pimp called Yuri. And of course there are guys after him. I'm like, what? Are you kidding? This movie seems... I almost want to give it away. I don't really want to own it anymore. I watched it again. I was like, oh, this was such a bad idea.
Well, if I come up for TIFF, you can give me that movie and I can give you my copy of Hunger.
Sure. We'll go. Done deal. And I think I win. I think I need to give you a player to be named later. Well, my takeaway, you kind of mentioned it earlier. My takeaway from Leaving Las Vegas, it is Cage's performance, because all lunacy aside, it is incredible what this guy can do. He kind of found a whole new gear of strange with this movie, because after this, it was no looking back. Like, don't get me wrong, before this, he did Raising Arizona and he did Wild at Heart. And those movies were admittedly really weird. He also did you ever see a movie called Vampire's Kiss?
I did not know.
Oh, it is gloriously absurd. You got to watch it.
Okay.
And he's not actually a vampire. He just thinks he is.
Oh.
Yeah. It's fantastic.
Good for him.
After Leaving Las Vegas was just when he totally went off the rails and became the cartoon that we now know as Nicolas Cage. So I think it was, you know, when he did this, when he got in touch with his real inner weirdo, and we gave him an Oscar for it, that it was like, well, this is what I am now. Get Jerry Bruckheimer on the phone.
You do enforce pretty bad habits when you do things like that.
There we go. Well, that's my call for the other side. We're going to have Brian's pick right after this. But first, the Backstreet Boys. Backstreet's back, all right. Hey, now,
Oh, that was neat. That was a simple one.
Yeah, I kind of ran out of road. Well, Brian's choice to marry up with the incredible Burt Wonderstone was probably the academic pick, and I'm kind of actually a little grumpy with myself that we didn't do something that I'll explain in a second. Brian has chosen The Prestige, the Christopher Nolan film from 2006 that, of course, stars Hugh Jackman and...
Christian Bale.
Thank you.
Scarlett Johansson.
It stars Hugh Jackman and Christian Bale as dueling magicians. Scarlett Johansson and Rebecca Hall are kind of femme fatales in there as well. Not really femme fatales. They're the female interests and protagonists of the story. There's also Michael Caine presiding over the whole fracas. The reason why I was grumpy with myself is after Burt Wonderstone, we probably could have just paired it up with The Prestige and The Illusionist.
Yeah, probably.
And I don't really know why I didn't do that.
I don't know. I mean, The Illusionist was okay. Well, I feel like The Prestige kind of wiped it out.
See, but that's the thing. I actually haven't seen The Illusionist, so this would have also been a perfect excuse.
That would have been.
Certainly in light of leaving Las Vegas, I really think that I would have been better off.
It is weird that you chose like a slight but lighthearted comedy, and then you were just like, yeah, I'll pair that up with the movie about the guy drinking to death.
Well, you know what? Like,
you didn't go for like... You can go for Ocean's Eleven
or The Cooler or no. I went hardcore. I think it's because I'm fascinated by Vegas. I think that's
the Hangover.
I dislike The Hangover even more in hindsight. That could have been my film that actually I don't think has aged well.
I don't think that's aged well either.
Yeah, no. But no, just Vegas just fascinates me. So I wanted like, you know, and that's the other thing is that the Vegas of Leaving Las Vegas doesn't really exist anymore.
Casino, then? You could have done Casino.
I could have done that, too. Shit, man. I'm just mailing it in now after 80
episodes. Let's just do the whole podcast over.
Yeah. Well, The Prestige. We're not going to tongue-bait The Prestige because I think it's kind of got a certain cachet among podcasters and bloggers of our ilk. It goes to the reason that we both dig it. Did you rewatch it for this show? No.
I did.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. And like, did anything jump out at you or this time around?
I think I've reaffirmed the fact that this is my favorite Christopher Nolan film.
Okay.
Yeah. And, I just, again, it's a movie that all final acts aside, I mean, a lot of it is predicated on the fact that magic isn't as interesting when you know what's happening behind it. And yet, when I see there are still moments in the movie where people are doing magic and you now know that it's not real, but it's still so interesting just the fact that they can do it to begin with, the fact that they've put thought into it and are able to change the world seemingly at whim. I mean, you get to know a lot of the tricks that they do. And so extrapolating from that, you can say, okay, well, when he drops the ball and somehow slips his shackles and puts them onto a prison guard, he's not actually a mythological, you know, bender of time and space, but it's still so awesome that he has the quickness and the skill to be able to do that. And yeah, so the joy of the magic is
it's
still
probably
there.
Sometimes it probably just comes down to, hey, I'm double jointed. No?
Yeah.
Like that is what it comes down to sometimes is things like dexterity and, you know, hell, just being able to like pop your shoulder at a joint.
Yeah. And that's in and of itself its own kind of magic because it's not something I can do.
No.
So it's still got that effect. I don't know. Seeing people do things that I can't do, like, is amazing to me. It's one of the reasons why I like Project Runway and Top Chef. It's like, you know, I might not in my normal life pick up cooking magazines or fashion magazines, but to see these people take nothing and then create something amazing that I can't even begin to fathom, it's incredible to me.
Yeah. No, I hear you because, you know, when I am being my more creative self, and you know, even just kind of to this end of things. You know, when I'm working on blogging things or podcasting things, I get inspired by working with other creative people. So when I used to, like, I grew up studying art and studying photography, and I used to like, for instance, working with musicians or working with dancers or working with actors to come up with something just because I found that there was a better creative energy that you would draw from them. So no matter what they're doing, just kind of seeing that kind of... that kind of execution, that kind of creativity, I can see why you would kind of draw that from Top Chef and Project Runway and that kind of thing, and certainly from something like The Prestige.
Yeah.
The thing that I latched on to with this go round this time that I watched it was, and it wasn't probably inspired in no small way by the fact that he has returned, was David Bowie as Nikola Tesla.
Yeah.
And he comes down to the line. He comes up with the line, and it's actually earlier in the movie than I remembered, that the saying goes that man's grasp exceeds his reach, which is not true, that man's grasp only exceeds his nerve.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is fascinated with science and technology, and I think the same day I watched this, I watched Around the World in 80 Days, which is another movie that says, you know, it's fascinated with Jules Verne and how what he just once thought were just crazy ideas are now completely possible. But with every one of these leaps forward that we go, I mean, I'm talking to you across just a series of cables and signals in something that just was completely not possible 15 years ago.
Yep.
You know, and this is, don't get me wrong, in some respects, things like this can be scary. In some respects, things like this can be used irresponsibly. But with every innovation and every grasp that man takes, that humanity takes, it's how much nerve do we have to take on this kind of responsibility and you know, showmanship, like not showmanship, but this kind of actual magic. So I latched on to that this time, and also because it kind of echoes the thought that keeps coming up of doing your act means getting your hands dirty. And I think that's what it means, is when you come up with these kinds of jumps in what's possible, it means getting your hands dirty and taking on responsibility.
Yeah.
And that, and like all of that is kind of encapsulated in that little moment of David Bowie as Tesla. So that was kind of what I fixated on this time around.
So yours is a lot deeper than mine. I just want to be able to do some damn magic.
I want to make the bird disappear, damn it. Well, back, like, kind of back to more what's on the screen. I think this might have to take the cake as the ultimate second time around movie.
Like getting it and liking it more second time around?
No. Well, yes, but no. When you watch this one, when you watch this movie twice, mm-hmm. you pick up all kinds of stuff. That's
oh yeah, no, it's in, because the best thing is a lot of times a movie that you have to watch a second time after like the turn, nice. You can kind of see.
Look at you go.
You know, you can kind of see what's happening, but this movie is so meticulous that it almost like is insulting that you didn't see it the first time.
Yeah.
It's impeccably done. It's insane.
Yeah. I've never, this is another movie where I'm actually kind of curious to read the book.
Yeah. I actually got it for my brother, because when my brother was younger, I had to like trick him into reading. And so like every Christmas I would get him like
You're
one year.
You're a true humanitarian.
I know. Well, it's one of those things. It's like, you know, I wish that I had read more when I was a kid. And this is coming from me. I read Jurassic Park in the second grade. I mean, like, I read all the time. So somehow I still wanted to read more. But I, like, for Christmas, I'd get him a comic book and then, like, the Red Badge of Courage.
Okay.
As, you know, I would do something like that. I'd, like, trick him into being like, okay, here's one for you. Here's one for your intellect and humanity. And so one year I got him the DVD of The Prestige and the book of The Prestige.
And it collected dust, didn't it?
Yeah, I don't think he ever. Yeah. I don't think he read the book. I need to steal that from him because I want to read it.
Yeah, no, I need to take a look at it as well. And then, like, I'll be curious to see how all that stuff is written, because it comes up so easily visually, and like you said, in just in the dumbest way, in the way that makes you wonder how the hell you didn't notice it the first time.
Yeah,
because I'm gonna be honest, I didn't really see it coming. Like neither turn. There's two. That's the beautiful part. I certainly didn't see Angier's turn coming. Borden's turn, I sort of had an inkling, just because I'm going to go into the assumption that most people have seen The Prestige. Just because in the late going, there's a shot where it just lingers on his little manservant guy. I can't remember what the other name, what his name is.
Alan.
Thank you. It lingers on him just long enough that I was like, wait a minute. I just had that little hesitation. So I sort of saw that one. The other one I had no idea. And of course, now that I watch it again, it's all over this friggin' movie. And, yeah. And not only that, but the thought of it is just totally screwed up.
No, it is incredible. Like, There are moments of dialogue between them, and when you view them through the lens of what you come to learn, it's just incredible. Like, how I ever thought that that was a normal conversation between two people who, like, were just kind of strangers to each other.
Right. Well, not only that, but in the late going, the conversations he has, or that Borden has with Sarah, again, it, like, you hear it the one time, and it just, it sounds like a husband and wife arguing. It sounds like the kind of, you know, kind of really cold, really vicious arguments that couples have sometimes. But then you watch it again, and it's like, I know exactly what they're talking about. And it just, it seems so friggin' obvious. But the fact that it's not, it's that very misdirection that magic is all about, right?
Yeah.
So it's got layers. I love that.
So many layers.
Yeah, yeah.
Flaky golden layers.
Wonderful gooey layers. Did you have a takeaway when you rewatched The Prestige? Was there like kind of one thing of like, watch it for this, or just something that stuck with you just that little bit more?
Again, the way that it's set up, because it's not told chronologically. No. And it's fantastic. The way that it's sorted isn't just there to confuse things. It's there to, it almost clarifies them more. Like, if you'd shown the film chronologically, it probably would have been more confusing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Wally Pfister's cinematography is absolutely gorgeous.
Yep. That might actually be my favorite opening shot in a movie.
With the hats?
Yeah.
I still, every once in a while, when I think of, like, if I were to make a movie, how I'd want it to look, I think of the you know, random shots, the establishing shots of the workshop with the little finches in all the cages and lights coming through the kind of pasted over windows. It's just like ethereally beautiful, and it's hard to understand how they got those shots.
Yeah. The one little takeaway that I had is I kind of got to thinking about it just because it's kind of the same era, is it kind of saddens me that we still don't have a really good Houdini movie.
Yeah, I was actually thinking that while watching Burt Wonderstone.
Yeah, that's true too.
And then oddly enough, when I was watching, do you watch the show Archer?
No, but I've heard a lot about it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And they've made like three different references random times in the entire show to how Houdini died.
Okay.
Specifically how he died. And I'm just like, why haven't we had a Houdini movie yet?
Well, there has been one, but it's not very good. It's with Catherine Zeta-Jones and Guy Pearce. It's called Death Defying Acts. It's
I do not remember that.
Yeah, I don't know that it played. Like, I think it just went straight to DVD. I believe it or not, I saw it at TIFF.
I think that Christopher Nolan should do that.
Just
because how fantastic The Prestige is and how beautiful it looks. Like, just
do it again.
Yeah.
I got to thinking, this is kind of sad. I got to thinking, but I'll talk about it because you mentioned TV earlier. I got to thinking about Houdini because I saw an episode of Pawn Stars where a guy comes in and he sells a Houdini straitjacket. So I was like, why isn't there a good Houdini movie?
Oh, Pawn Stars.
Yes, yes, yes. But before we devolve into Pawn Stars, we're going to sign off. Come on back on Monday, April 8th. We'll be discussing Danny Boyle's new film, Trance. Brian writes in a litany of places, so I'm going to let him rhyme them all off.
Yeah, I write for the film stage. I write occasionally some TV reviews for WeGotThisCovered.com. And, of course, I write for my own site, DearFilm.net. I've got some reviews coming out on the site. They'll be random. It's not worth mentioning by name. But I do have two new podcast episodes that should be hitting fairly quickly next week. One is for Oz the Great and Powerful, which was voted as the possible best film of March.
Oops.
And, yeah, that was a mistake. And then the other is going to be a podcast on Spring Breakers, which was voted on as probably the worst film of March, which is just insanity because it looks amazing, but I'm glad that it won because that means I get to talk about it.
There you go. I'm waiting on it. It kind of fell in between my schedule, so I can't get a podcast out about it. I gotta hold on until Trance. Well, there we go. Yeah. And,
well, hell, if you want to come on mine.
And there we go. Look at how well that worked out.
Yeah, synergy.
Exactly. Where can people find you on Twitter?
Twitter.com/BrianJRoan. BrianJRoan.
Fantastic. My site is thematinee.ca for more podcast content. You can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. And you can subscribe using Stitcher Radio, Listen, or Apple's podcasting app. You can find them on Blueberry or the iTunes Music Store. Everything gives you handy ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. Feedback on Burt Wonderstone, Leaving Las Vegas, The Prestige, or the perfect heist movie cast can be left in the comment section of the site. You can email ryan@thematinee.ca or find me on Twitter, where I'm matinee_ca, or Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. Any final thoughts, Mr. Rowan?
You couldn't have me on for trance, could you?
Nope.
Had to be Wonderstone.
Nope. Yeah, that's right. Sorry. Hey, listen, if it makes you feel better, I'm having trouble filling the trance slot, and I think I finally got it after asking like six different people.
Why would people not be excited for trance?
I can't throw my guests under the bus. It partially comes down to my OCD and how I've got this whole crazy thing mapped out.
Okay.
So it has to do with the specific people I asked.
All right.
So it was a timing thing. Well, for Brian, I'm Ryan. This has been WMAT 92.1 signing off. Got one more in there.
You marvelous son of a bitch.